We turn to Numbers 17 for our reading. The Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the Israelites and get 12 staffs from them, one from the leader of each of their ancestral tribes. Write the name of each man on the staff. On the staff of Levi, write Aaron's name, for there must be one staff for the head of each ancestral tribe. Place them in the tent of meeting in front of the testimony, where I meet with you. The staff belonging to the man I choose will sprout, and I will rid myself of this constant grumbling against you by the Israelites." So Moses spoke to the Israelites, and their leaders gave him 12 staffs, one for the leader of each of their ancestral tribes, and Aaron's staff was among them. Moses placed the staffs before the Lord in the tent of the testimony. The next day, Moses entered the tent of the testimony and saw that Aaron's staff, which represented the house of Levi, had not only sprouted, but had budded, blossomed, and produced almonds. Then Moses brought out all the staffs from the Lord's presence to all the Israelites. They looked at them, and each man took his own staff. The Lord said to Moses, "Put back Aaron's staff in front of the testimony, to be kept as a sign to the rebellion, This will put an end to their grumbling against me, so that they will not die." Moses did just as the Lord commanded him. The Israelites said to Moses, "We shall die. We are lost. We are all lost." I suppose "we are doomed" might be a fair paraphrase there. "Anyone who even comes near the tabernacle of the Lord will die. Are we all going to die?" So who would be a leader? In the last chapter, a bunch of people had complained against God, and the earth had opened up and swallowed them up. Grumbling led to judgment. But grumbling, as we've seen a few times in Numbers, can kind of grow as it kind of begins. As someone kind of grumbles to someone grumbles to another, you get a kind of culture of it. But the story in the previous chapter is a reminder that there's really no future in that. That if you trade in untruth, if you pass on half-truths, it will never have a good outcome. It will never have a good ending. And obviously, that particular experience in chapter 16 was an attempt for God to say, well, you need to take very seriously what you say and what you claim and when you complain and when you grumble against leaders. Someone has said that the Lord's presence is a high voltage zone. In the New Testament, there's a statement in Hebrews that says, "Our God is a consuming fire." So the Lord's presence, a high voltage zone. God is dangerous. God is not to be messed with. That's a lesson that comes out again and again in the Old Testament and the New Testament. So who would be a leader? Who would be a leader when every now and again people start to take a pop at you as a leader? Who would be a leader in such circumstances? Now, we thought a bit this morning about this word. We see in this chapter a measure of vulnerability, that being a leader does make people vulnerable. So Aaron and Moses were vulnerable to the accusations of the people. They were vulnerable to the complaints of the people. If things went right, well, no one noticed. If things went wrong, well, then Moses and Aaron were blamed. A leader is in the public eye. Everyone knows who they are and they know what they do. You know, we make a mistake and maybe our wife or our husband or our children notice it and they laugh and they remind us of it. They make a mistake and everybody knows. Laura Koonsberg tells everybody about the political mistakes of British politicians. What people think, what people say is scrutinised. That's the issue of being a leader. At times it feels as though you're living in a goldfish bowl. I remember when we moved into One Grand Avenue, we had someone from the church living just around the corner, we had someone from the church living just across the road, and then someone else living just a little bit further across the road, and then someone just up the road. And you kind of think, well, you know, you have to kind of behave yourself. You know, you have to kind of act a little bit carefully because people are seeing what you're seeing. Seeing what you're doing. Many of my contemporaries who began in Christian leadership 30-odd, 40 years ago, many of them are no longer in Christian leadership. They kind of looked out like I look out today and they decided that they'd had enough. You know, when cabinet ministers do this, they say, we're going to not be a cabinet minister any longer because we need to spend a little bit more time with our family. That's what they say. Christian leaders say different things. We feel that God is moving us into other regions. You know, I feel that my time here has come to a close. And lots of other kind of euphemisms. There is vulnerability. And we need, as we've been thinking in Numbers, to have something of an attitude adjustment. The public gaze, the criticism, the hassle, can become too much. Being a leader can be a bit like what it means to be black. Ben Lindsay, a Christian leader, wrote a book about with the title, We Need to Start to Talk About Race. And he said that being black in Britain is like being on the first day at school every day. You remember what it was like to be at school for the first day? The first day of school every day. I remember my first day at school. I remember everyone seemed to be crying. I think I started crying because everyone else was crying. I don't know why people were crying. It was warm. It was warmer than it was at my house, and the lunch was a lot better than you got at our house. What were they crying for? They should have been laughing. Like the first day at school every day. It can almost be a surprise to some people that leaders have feelings. Sometimes the assumption is that leaders are kind of Teflon-coated, that they come out of a kind of particular unusual species that feel nothing. So sometimes Christian leaders have this conversation with people, and people say, well, I want you to know that I am sensitive. And I feel it when people say unkind things about me. And the assumption is that they are the only sensitive people in the world. Although usually when you talk to them, you find that they're not sensitive at all. They are so blunt and so destructive that they ought to be kind of put in a quarantine zone. But the assumption that a leader is sensitive and that they might be somehow vulnerable to attacks is something that they don't always realize. Harsh words, snide comments, complaints can sting and wound. So we see vulnerability. There's vulnerability. But there's also, here in this chapter, validation. So Moses says, let every leader of each tribe bring a staff, a rod, to the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, and we're going to lay them before the place of worship, the place where Moses meets with God. And here's an opportunity to put the record straight, to deal with this issue finally. Who is the leader? Who is the one that God wants people to follow? And that's what happens. The 12 ancestral leaders bring their staff and they bring it to the tent of meeting. Now, it's interesting that it is a staff, a rod, that is chosen. And that the test is, the staff of the man whom I choose will sprout. Now, it's a weird thing, isn't it? You kind of put a walking stick away in the cupboard on a Friday evening, and you kind of open the door, and it kind of bursts open, and there's a great big bush in the cupboard. And you kind of think, this is a strange thing, and it would be a strange thing, wouldn't it? We don't want walking sticks, generally speaking, to do this, but this is a sign. There's 12 staffs, 12 rods. They're laid here in the presence of God, and one of those staffs will sprout, and that will be the sign that this is God's man, God's appointed. Now, this staff, idea of a staff, has quite a history. Aaron's staff was with him when he went to visit Pharaoh, demanding that the people were let go from Egypt. The staff was used to strike the waters of the Nile when it was cursed and turned into blood. The staff was a symbol of miraculous power and authority. You remember the words of Psalm 23? Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. The shepherd is the king, and these were the signs of his kingship. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. The idea of a staff or a rod springing to life is a remarkable thing, isn't it? The idea that something which is cut down and now dead should bring life is just remarkable. Rebirth, fresh life. Of course, that's what is at the heart of the Christian message, isn't it? We believe that someone died on a cross and he rose again. We believe that from a place of death, life has emerged. That's what we believe. That's the heart of our faith. And here we see that kind of idea being communicated in this validation ceremony. The test is of remarkable fruitfulness. Not just a tiny little bud appearing at the end of the rod. That would be amazing, wouldn't it, in itself? But a proper bush and almonds growing from the staff and the rod. Now, it's quite a fun thing at Christmas time to dig up the Brussels sprouts. Now, Brussels sprouts, as we know, come in plastic bags, but the way they grow on a stick. They grow on a very, very long green stick, and they're bushy at the top, and all the Brussels sprouts grow around it like a crown. It's quite striking, really. You can kind of walk around, and it looks a little bit like Aaron's rod. No almonds, but sprouts. It's not a miracle, because it's kind of planted in the ground. There's roots there. That's what makes it grow. But it is remarkable. Aaron's rod is fruitful. In the presence of God, it's fruitful. Here in this high voltage zone, Aaron is marked out as the one who is fruitful. He's validated. He is the one who can approach God with extreme caution, but with freedom. He is the one who can come and be a representative to receive from God and to bring an offering in the tent of meeting for the sins of the people. So this validation is a kind of vindication. Aaron is vindicated. He had been complained against, he'd been grumbled against. People said harsh things against him, but here, suddenly, there was vindication. The rod of Aaron is fruitful. It buds and it bears fruit. Now, there's kind of an irony in this, a remarkable irony, if you kind of understand that Aaron was a Levite, and the Levites were the priestly family. They didn't have a particular allotment of land. They did not work on the land. They worked in the tent of meeting. They did the spiritual stuff. They didn't do the stuff that got their hands dirty. So the people who didn't grow fruit and vegetables, who didn't experience daily fruitfulness, the rod of Aaron, the Levite, bears fruit. It's a remarkable thing. It's an ironic thing. Those who are removed from the soil because they're specifically given to the task of spiritual things, they're the ones who are fruitful. Now, people know that I haven't got a reputation for being particularly practical. I'm certainly glad that some people do my electrical work, some people do my plumbing work, some people do carpentry and other things in our home. People know that I can, I hope, preach a sermon, but I would struggle to hang a door. I can grow things. When I've got time, I quite enjoy that. Me and Jeremy Corman, that's probably one of the only things that we've got in common. The allotment. Not the same one, it has to be said. That would just be a little bit too close for comfort. Vindication. God's eye view. Put back Aaron's staff, verse 10, in front of the Ark of the Covenant to be kept as a sign to the rebellious. Moses did just as the Lord had commanded him. This will put an end to their grumbling against me so that they will not die. Moses did just as he had commanded. Now, this is what makes it strange, isn't it? The people didn't know this. They didn't know. They didn't know that this encounter was going on between God and Moses. So they suddenly say, we're doomed. We're going to die. They repeat it again and again. We're going to die. We're dead. We're finished. We're dead meat. We are history. We're all going to die. You know, we've kind of complained against God's servant. We've kind of chosen the wrong side. And it's quite plain that now Aaron is plainly God's man, that we are in trouble. Big trouble. God's eye view. God's eye view is that they're going to be okay because Aaron's staff is there in the presence of God. Now, interestingly, and this is a bit of a story in the New Testament. In Hebrews 9 and verse 4, we're told that in the Ark of the Covenant, there was Aaron's rod that budded, a golden bowl of manna, the bread that was provided, and the Ten Commandments. In the Ark of the Covenant, there was these symbols of God speaking, God providing, and God demonstrating his authority in life. So here was something, a symbol that was placed here to communicate something that was very, very clear. People said, look, we're lost. But the rod said, no, you've got a representative before God. You've got someone who is life-giving, who can represent you so that you do not need to die, so that you can be forgiven, and so that you can approach God and experience him in your life. So this event was a big deal. It was not a minor deal in the Old Testament, because in the New Testament, the writer of the Hebrews says, well, this was very special. Three very key events: the Ten Commandments, manna, which fed a million or so people over years, and Aaron's rod that budded. This is a really important event. The person that people spoke against was vindicated. He was validated. That which is dead sprouted life. Does that sound familiar? Does it sound familiar to you? Does it sound familiar to the message of the gospel? Does it sound familiar to the cross of Jesus? You know, the people, when they'd experienced this miracle concerning Aaron's rod, found it really difficult to believe that God could be merciful. You know, for some people, this can be their common experience. Some people want to experience God as more severe than he actually is. Some people want to experience God as more merciful than he actually is. But some people just can't imagine that God's severity could be tempered by mercy. We spoke last week about how some people play a game of snakes and ladders, and all the snakes are long, and all the ladders are short. And sometimes in our dealings with God, we can imagine that he is all sternness and severity, and everything must turn out badly. But no, there is mercy. There is mercy. Yes, God is a God of absolute holiness. There is this high voltage zone around God. And we're reminded, though, that in Hebrews 9, after that statement about Aaron's rod that budded, that there are these words: how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? Yeah, by nature we're all dead meat. By nature we're all condemned, dead in trespasses and sins. But we have a man who represents us before God. We have one who was dead for us, and yet from death has brought life. What a gracious thing. It can be hard to believe in God's mercy. It can be hard to believe that God can be kind to us. In C.S. Lewis's The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, there is an incident where the children are talking about the lion, Aslan, and they ask, is Aslan safe? And the reply is, no, Aslan is not safe, but he is good. And of course, that's true about God, isn't it? God is not safe. God is surrounded by a high voltage zone. He's not to be messed with. He's not safe, but he is good. He is good to those who recognize their need of him and come through his appointed man, his appointed representative, to receive mercy. For the Israelites, wounded by their complaints and aware that they were in the wrong with God, the representative was Aaron, and the rod that budded was the sign that he was the one that God had appointed and was going to come into the presence of God and bring offerings in their place. For us, it is someone greater than Aaron, our great high priest, the great high priest, Jesus, who has offered his life, died, and been raised again. It's remarkable to think that in this story from Numbers chapter 17, unpromising story about a stick, can point us to the tree. The tree of life upon which Jesus died for us. We're going to be looking at this again in a couple of weeks' time when Richard is going to preach about the snake that bites and kills and then becomes a snake that's raised on a pole that people look to and are healed and live. Jesus spoke about that in John chapter 3. And said, if I am lifted up, well then men will be saved. What a remarkable thing that through a symbol of death, a dead symbol, there can be life. Is he safe? No. But he is good. Amen.